The Book of Judges, I've called this talk, Where Did It All Go Wrong? Because essentially, there isn't a lot of good things you can say about the people of Israel when you read through the Book of Judges. The only thing you can really say about them is that they are consistent. And that isn't actually a great thing either, because what they're consistent in doing is breaking every single one of the rules that God laid down for them to follow. So, what is this all about then? Why would you have a book in the Bible which is dark and is horrible, and all the people of Israel appear to do is get worse and worse and worse and worse? Well, let's start off with a little bit of background. The book of Judges starts exactly where the book of Joshua left off. Indeed, it actually repeats verbatim, almost word for word, one of the last parts of the book of Joshua, when the people of Israel are still conquering the land. You could be forgiven for thinking, when you've read the book of Joshua, that the people of Israel had already conquered the whole of their land, but they hadn't. It was very, very piecemeal. There were still large amounts of territory left untaken. So at the beginning of the book of Judges, we hear them asking God, who shall go up to fight against our enemies? And God said, oh, I'll send Judah first. So Judah go up and take their territory, but they fail to drive out the Canaanites. They intend to subject them to slave labor instead. So it's possible that the idea we have, or some critics have, of the people of Israel coming in, smashing up everything they can find and killing everybody, isn't what actually happened. Occasionally, you get something like that. But very often when it says they killed all the Canaanites and there were none left, and then it says they subjected the Canaanites to slave labor, or they couldn't drive all of the Ammonites or Canaanites or Jebusites out of the land. So we can forget about that. The problem is, though, they were supposed to remove them and to expel them, because otherwise they would go and start worshipping other gods. Why they would do that, we will come to in a minute. But we get from verbatim, from the book of Judges, word for word, the story of Caleb and his nephew, Othniel, the son of his younger brother, taking Hebron, and a city Caleb wanted to live in, and as a result, he is given Caleb's daughter, and Caleb's daughter persuades Caleb to give her a field and a spring so that she would have status in Israel. Now, mark that, because we'll be coming back to it later. So, that's what happens in chapter 1. Just a brief overview and a talk that there's unfinished business. Now, in Judges chapter 2, which could almost be a footnote to Joshua, an angel appears to the people of Israel and tells them that they have fallen. They have started worshipping other gods, and as a result, God will no longer drive tribes out from before them. And the people of Israel all weep and they cry, but then they just go home. They don't do anything about it. They just carry on and go home. And Joshua goes home too, to his territory, and he dies in peace. But the whole book bears out his warning that he gave to the people. You cannot serve Yahweh, Joshua said. Yes, we can, they replied. All right, says Joshua, but I hold heaven and earth as witnesses against yourselves that you've made this promise, because it can't be done. And he sets up a stone as a witness, which shows that they'd made this promise, and they're going to break it. Chapter 2 is an executive summary, what follows, of the book of Judges. If the book of Judges was a council report or a government report into what had gone wrong, this would be the executive summary which explains what has been found in the report, what's in the inquiry, and what the conclusions will be. Starting at verse 11 of chapter 2. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Starting at verse 10. After that, whole generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation grew up, who neither knew the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord their God of their fathers, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods of the peoples around them. They provoked the Lord to anger because they forsook and served Baal and the Asherahs. In his anger against Israel, the Lord handed them over to raiders to plunder them. He sold them to their enemies all around. And they were no longer whom they were no longer able to resist. Whenever Israel went out to fight, the hand of the Lord was against them to defeat them, just as he had sworn to them. They were in great distress. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of their raiders. Yet they would not listen to their judges, but prostituted themselves to other gods and worshipped them. Unlike their forefathers, they quickly turned from the way in which their fathers had walked, the way of obedience to the Lord, the way of obedience to their Lord's commands. Whenever the Lord raised up a judge for them, he was with the judge and saved them out of the hands of their enemies as long as the judge lived. For the Lord had compassion on them as they groaned under those who oppressed and afflicted them. But when the judge died, and the people returned to their ways, even more corrupt than those of their fathers, following other gods and serving and worshipping them, they refused to give up their evil practices and stubborn ways. Therefore, the Lord was very angry with Israel and said, because this nation has violated the covenant which I laid down for their forefathers and has not listened to me, I will no longer drive out from before them all the nations Joshua left when he died, but I will use them to test Israel and see whether they will keep the way of the Lord and walk as their forefathers did. The Lord had allowed these nations to remain. He did not drive them out at once by giving them into the hands of Joshua. Essentially, right through the book, we get story after story after story of the judges raised up by God to test the people of Israel against the nations surrounding them. So let's see how they get on. Let's start in the east and the south of the country. And we start with three judges. The first judge, Othniel, arrives because the people of Judah are being oppressed by the Canaanites. That's by the king of Aram. So Othniel rises up, takes Israel to war, and he defeats the men of Aram. Quick footnote. Judge. Why is Othniel called a judge if he's not actually sitting in a courtroom, but he's taking Israel to war? When we think judge, you tend to think someone in a courtroom and in a black wig and wearing a gown. When God is talking about a judge, he's talking about a tribal leader, a clan leader, a chieftain, if you like. The closest thing to compare it to is probably the comic book character Judge Dredd. A lot of you probably haven't heard of him, but Judge Dredd is a judge in a post-apocalyptic world where the Justice Department has taken over the government system. It's actually meant as a satire of modern politics, but essentially you have judges who run the government, judges who go out on the streets with the power to arrest, imprison, and execute people, and judges who deal with the administration. The whole thing is run by the Justice Department. Now, this is a satire. It's not real, of course. It's a comic book. But it's close-ish to the kind of thing we're talking about here. The judges don't just judge. The judges fight.
the judges support Israel. So first we have Caleb's younger brother who saves Israel. And the really interesting thing about him is, he's the wrong person. He's the younger brother. What's he doing saving Israel? What happened to Caleb's son? Answer, well, God uses misfits. And the next one, Ehud, is even more of a misfit. Ehud the left-handed, he can't use his right hand. That would have been seen as very odd in the days of Israel. But Ehud saves the men of Benjamin, we're going across the Jordan again, who were being oppressed by Moab. They fought Moab before, they've beaten Moab before, but Moab is now fighting Israel again. Ehud takes the tribute of the Benjamites to the king of Moab and kills him. Now this king is the cliche of a king. He's really, really, really fat. And I think that is there because everyone loves a story where your villain looks like a villain. Who doesn't like a story like that? A story of cliches where the whole thing is blown out of proportion. That's just a method of storytelling. So is the death of the king. Ehud pretends he's got a secret message for him, goes up to the king and stabs him in the guts. And he's so fat that the knife disappears inside his stomach. And after Ehud's locked the doors of the king's upper room and run away, the aides don't want to open the door for a very long time because, you see, they think the king must be in there doing a massive poo. And they're too embarrassed to disturb him. It does actually say that. I'm not making this up, folks. And I think that's in there again for it's humorous and it's just a story everyone loves. You have to remember, the Judges isn't a portrayal of history as it happened when it happened. So we have Ehud. Then we have Shamgar. Shamgar is judge number three, and he is a foreigner. A foreigner, not even an Israelite originally, but he's still the one who saves Israel. And he kills 600 Philistines with an ox goad. Except if he did actually kill that many, we're not so sure. But the point is, he was a judge who saved Israel. The first three judges are all misfits. None of them fits the bill for a strong, wise judge. But so far, the judges seem to be doing okay. The next judge, Deborah, does even better, and she's even more controversial because she's a strong-willed woman. If you read the story of Deborah in Judges number 4 and Judges number 5, you could be forgiven for thinking that all the men in Israel in Deborah's time were a complete load of wusses. They have been taken over by King Jabin because, again, they broke the commandment with God and went off to serve other gods. As a result, they're taken over by King Jabin. Deborah the judge comes to the fore. She's a married woman, but it's her, not her husband, who leads Israel. That would have been seen as very unusual in the time that this is written. We're talking about a completely patriarchal society. So she calls for Barak and tells Barak that God has commanded him of Naphtali to take the men of Zebulun and the men of Ephraim and to go and fight against Jabin and Sisera, his commander. And Barak goes, I'll only go if you come with me, but if you won't, I'm not going anywhere. I'm scared. And Deborah said, all right, I'll come with you, but you won't kill Sisera, the commander of the army, with his 900 chariots. A woman will do that instead. So they defeat the enemy. But Barak is killed by Jael. She is another woman who's not typically a blood Israelite, but belongs to Moses' father-in-law's clan. Her husband had fled from the Israelites before the battle started and pitched his tent somewhere else, obviously hoping he could stay out of it. But when Sisera comes along, Jael welcomes him in, gives him milk and cheese in a bowl, and once he's asleep, she kills him. She gets the credit. In the worship song in Judges chapter 6, praising God for their victory, it's the women who get the credit. Barak is mentioned too, but it's Deborah and it's Yael. I prefer the Hebrew sound of it. It's now a very popular name in Israel, Yael, who are the ones who are mentioned and praised for what they did. So by Judges number 6, things seem to be going okay again. But in Judges number 7, oh great, we're right back where we started. The people have gone to worship other gods, and the Midianites are oppressing them and persecuting them. Now, why might this be happening? Why would you go and worship other gods? Well, it's not quite as difficult as unfair as it sounds, or as odd as it sounds, because worshipping the gods of the land is a trendy idea which is popular then and it's popular now. In the very famous book, The Color Purple, a book about racism among housemaids in the United States, the main character, an oppressed housemaid, prays a prayer. And the prayer goes like this. Dear God, dear stars, dear sky, dear peoples, dear everything, dear God. It's the idea that everything is divine. God is in everything. And it's very popular now too. A spiritualist will tell you everything is Gaia. That breeze is Gaia. That star is Gaia. That rabbit is Gaia. And sometimes they play that game with a dead relative too. So they say, that star is Mummy. That breeze is Mummy. And so it goes on. It's the idea that there is a universe and it's divine. In those days, the people would have gone off worshipping other gods, not because of an idea that everything was divine, but because there were gods for everything. A god of the sun, a god of the harvest, a god of rain. And they were known as the Baals, or the masters. It made sense to people to pray to the Baals. After all, God's okay for politics, but if it doesn't rain, doesn't it make sense to pray to the God who's supposed to control the rain? Maybe that's what I should do. It's what everyone else is doing. I want to be in touch with the family members who've died. And they say that can happen. The Canaanites say that our God, their gods, are just like a family. That makes much more sense than having one God in charge of everything. So before we judge them too harshly as being pretty stupid, let's look at ourselves and ask ourselves, what idols do we have? What do we worship instead of God? And it's time to meet judge number 5. After a prophet arrives to tell the Israelites what a mess they've made, he summons a judge. He raises up a judge. And the judge happens to be Gideon the scaredy cat. I mean it. He does come across as being a complete scaredy cat. He's threshing grain in a wine press. In other words, he's hiding. And so he's threshing grain in a place where it won't come out properly because you need to thresh grain in the open air. Everybody sniggers. What kind of man does that? And an angel of the Lord appears to him and said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." And of course, Gideon says, "What, me?" And the angel says, "God has raised you up to deliver Israel." And like Moses before him, Gideon tries to get out of it. He doesn't want to do it. He looks for every excuse he can think of. You can read the whole story in Judges chapter 6. Unfortunately, there's no way of Gideon getting out of this. God tells him to do it, and God pushes him into doing it. He asks for a sign. God gives him a sign. He asks for another sign. God gives him another sign. And while all this is going on, Gideon gets a new name. He tears down his father's altar to Baal and makes another altar to God. He does it at night, hoping he's not going to get caught, and guess what? They catch him at it anyway. But he's given his new name, Jerubbaal. Baal must contend with him, because his father says when the people come along demanding Gideon's head for smashing their altar up, Baal's a god, he can defend himself. What are you taking his side for? In Judges chapter 7, we get this idea that the victory is God's and it's not Gideon's. To prove that point, we get the wonderful story of God dividing Gideon's army in two. Anyone who's afraid can go home, and nearly half the army run away. Gideon, you've still got too many men. Watch them drinking at the river. And God chooses the men who lap water from their hands, not people who kneel down in front of the river to drink. There's an argument that this might be because that was a way of worshipping the river, but that's neither here nor there. The point is, Gideon now's got only 300 men, and he's supposed to fight an army that completely outnumbers him. And he does it by surrounding the army, blowing trumpets, yelling and waving torches in the middle of the night. It's a brilliant tactic. It always works. One of the cleverest ways of defeating an army that's bigger than yours is to pretend that you've got more men than you have. Do it in the right place, and the army will panic. So Gideon the scaredy cat is becoming Gideon the mighty warrior. And it all happened because he went down to the Midianites' camp in the middle of the night and found out the Midianites were more scared of him than he was of them. You can read the full story in chapter 7. Chapter 8, things seem to be getting even better. Gideon is behaving like a mighty warrior, a mighty man of God. From verses 1 to 22, he marches out to fight the people, to fight the Midianites, and he defeats them, and he fights them again, and he defeats them. He also has to deal with members of Israel's tribes who don't want to come with him. He tears down a tower, and he tears some men's flesh with briars because they wouldn't feed his army. Some have said this proves that Gideon's actually not such a nice man. He's got a violent temper. But we do need to remember we're talking about a time where if you didn't have an axe or a spear to defend your property, someone with a weapon might come along, decide he wants it, and kill you for it. We can't look at this in 21st century terms and say that it's too harsh, because we're looking at over 2,000 years ago. But anyway, Gideon defeats the Midianites, and he's asked to be the king of Israel. And the answer Gideon gives seems to be absolutely fantastic. Gideon chapter 8, verse 22. But Gideon told them, the people of Israel, I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. What a fabulous answer. We're looking at a man of God here, guys. Or are we? The next thing Gideon asks for is an earring from every man who'd plundered the Midianites. And when they give it to him, he melts it all down in the furnace and uses it to make a statue which he worships. Oh, Gideon. It's a really, really disappointing end to the story. Not only does Gideon worship an idol, which he wasn't supposed to do, but although he said, I don't want to be a king, he lives like a king. He has many wives and has 70 sons. And one of them, who's born of a concubine, that's a woman who he was with but wasn't officially his wife, is called Abimelech. And Abimelech means son of a king. So Gideon starts brilliantly. He finishes badly. And regrettably, this is something which you will see happening time and time again, not just through the book of Judges, but through the Bible and right through the church too. Amazing ministers, wonderful ministers, they start so well and they end so badly. Or worse, when they die, something really, really terrible is unearthed about them and it ruins everything. The meaning of that story is you can't build a monument to people. You'll always be disappointed. And when Gideon dies, it's even worse. The people of Israel go back to worshipping other gods and they don't show kindness to Gideon. They don't show kindness to his family. In fact, what they do next is gather round Abimelech, the son of a king, who's decided he'd rather like to be a king, and he persuades the men of Shechem, the nearest town, to kill all of Gideon's sons so only he can be king. And a curse is laid on him by Gideon's son Jotham. Listen to this parable because it's important and it becomes important later. Listen to me, citizens of Shechem, that God may listen to you. One day, the trees went out to anoint a king for themselves. They said to the olive tree, "Be our king." But the olive tree answered, "Should I give up my oil by which gods and men are honored to hold sway over the trees?" Next, the trees said to the fig tree, "Come and be our king." But the fig tree replied, "Should I give up my fruit so good and sweet that to hold sway over the trees?" Then the tree said to the vine, "Come and be our king." But the vine answered, "Should I give up my wine, which cheers both gods and men, to hold sway over the trees?" Finally, all the trees said to the thorn bush, "Come and be our king." The thorn bush said to the trees, If you really want to anoint me king over you, come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, then let fire come out from the thorn bush and consume the cedars of Lebanon." "Now," says Jotham, "if you have acted honorably and in good faith when you made Abimelech king, and if you have been fair to Jerubbaal, Gideon, and his family, and if you have treated him as he deserved, and to think my father fought for you, risking his life to rescue you from the hands of the Midianites. But today you have revolted against my father's family, murdered his 70 sons on a single stone, and made Abimelech, the son of his slave girl, king over the citizens of Shechem, because he is your brother. If then you have acted honorably and in good faith towards Jerubbaal and his family today, may Abimelech be your joy, and may you be his too. But if you have not, let fire come out of Abimelech and consume you, citizens of Shechem and Beth Shiloh. And may fire come out from you, citizens of Shechem and Beth Shiloh, and consume Abimelech." Point of that parable? The only kind of person who wants to be a king over you is the kind of person only a crazy idiot would want to be a king. What kind of fool wants to take shelter in a thorn bush? And that's exactly what happened. First, Abimelech tries to be king, and he starts an argument with the citizens of Shechem, and he kills them. And then Abimelech is killed in a siege, most humiliatingly, because a woman drops a millstone on his head and cracks his skull. He asks his armor bearer to kill him because he didn't want it to be said that a woman killed Abimelech. But the story gets out anyway and serves him right. Next, Judges chapter 10, that's where we are now, we have another judge, Tola, the judge of Issachar, judge number 6. Not much known about him. Then we have Jair, to Judge, Judge number 7. He's from, we don't know much about him either. Except that his family holds sway over a large part of Israel. He gives his sons towns to look after, about 30 of them. But by the time we get to verse 8, we have problems again. The people of Israel are worshipping other gods, and they're being oppressed by the Ammonites and about 3 other tribes too. And they cry out to God for help. And God's reply to them this time is, no. Verse 11 of chapter 10. The Lord replied, When the Egyptians, the Amorites, the Ammonites, the Philistines, the Sidonites, the Achillamites, and the Menomites oppressed you, and you cried out to me for help, did I not save you from their hands? But you have forsaken me and followed other gods, so I will no longer save you. Go and cry out to the gods you have chosen. Let them save you when you're in trouble. But the Israelites said to the Lord, we have sinned. Do for us whatever you think best, but please rescue us now. Then they got rid of the foreign gods among them and served the Lord, and he could bear Israel's misery no longer. This is a display of the grace of God. We're looking at a broken nation, a broken people who you know are going to be disobedient again the minute God rescues them. So does he, but he can't bear to see them oppressed. He can't watch it. It's like a parent when you're wondering what on earth you're going to do with your child, but you still can't bear to see your child suffer. Because however terrible they are, they're still your kid. And so he gives them Jephthah. Judge number 7. Just checking my list. No, judge number 8 now. We're on judge number 8. There are 2 insignificant judges you can easily forget about. So we're now on judge number 8. What do we know about Jephthah? Well, for a start, he looks like exactly the right person to be Israel's deliverer. He's a warrior. That's fantastic. You can read all about him in Judges 11. He's also another misfit. Are there any people here who aren't misfits? Anyone who we've heard of? Gideon's a misfit. He's a coward. Deborah's a misfit. She's the wrong gender. Ehud, Shamgar, Othniel, all misfits. Here's another one, Jephthah. He's thrown out of his father's house when his father dies because he's not his mother's son. Sorry, because he's not the official wife's son, and is told, you're having no share with us. Clear off. And so he becomes a warrior. But then the people of Israel come to him and say that if he will save them, he will be their ruler. He will be their leader. They don't make him a king, but they make him a judge. It looks like the righting of a wrong. And if that's not good, here's something even better. In a dispute with the Ammonites, where Jephthah tries to talk instead of starting a fight, he comes across as knowing the history of the journey to Israel backwards. They try to say, you took our land, give it back. He says, that's not the way it is. Here's the story. 2 of your tribes we didn't even plunder. 1 of them we plundered because you started a fight. He knows his stuff. Or does he? Because his mistake, later on in the chapter, is to offer the first thing that comes out of his door as a sacrifice, an offering to God. He knows the history, but he doesn't know the God who made that history. He thinks he's like a Canaanite who needs to be pacified with a sacrifice. And who should come out of the door? after he's defeated the Ammonites? His daughter. His inheritance. It was a terrible, foolish vow that he'd made. In his distress, perhaps we can forgive him for saying, "You have brought me low, miserable of all men, because I have made a vow to the Lord which I cannot break." Annoyingly, the Bible doesn't condemn this in the way we want it to. It doesn't say what a horrible man Jephthah was, which we would really like it to do, how evil it was, how disgusting it was. Why not? Well, partly because we're living in a time where human sacrifice was considered normal. God saw it as evil, but the people around him didn't. And also because it's pretty self-evident that it was wrong. In fact, from then on, there's a day of mourning for Jephthah, his daughter, from the whole of the people of Israel. Chapter 12. We can just skirt over that one. Jephthah is vindicated in a dispute with the people of Ephraim and Manasseh, which is only noteworthy because it's the first time that Israelites fight each other. But sadly, it's not the last. After Jephthah dies, there's a new judge, Ibzan of Bethlehem, who brings in daughters from outside his clan to marry his sons, and he marries his sons to women outside the clan. So maybe he's actually trying to push for his influence outside of the clan and over more of Israel. We don't know. Ilon, the Zebulunite, comes next. There's not known much about him except that he rules for 6 years. Then Abdon, the city of Halil, who has 70 offspring, sons and grandsons, and they ride 70 donkeys. In other words, he is greater than Jair of Bethlehem, who also had 30 sons who rode 30 donkeys. So by the end of chapter 12, they actually seem to be doing okay. We've had a few more judges. We've had two others mentioned. There's nothing particularly awful about them, but there's nothing particularly wonderful either. So maybe they were just okay. But now it's time to meet our last judge, and it's time to move away from the hill country to the east and the south where we've been, and to go west to where the city of Tel Aviv is now, and to join the clan of the tribe of Dan, who appear in the beginning of the story trying to sort out a home for themselves. They're having problems. The Israelites have wandered off again, and they're worshipping other gods. And they are being oppressed now by the Philistines. Who's heard of the Philistines? Thought you had. Yep, they're the most well-known enemy, aren't they? That means sea people. So there's an argument that the Philistines came from Europe. They came from the sea. Some people say they came from Greece, from Crete and places like that, but that's neither here nor there. The point is, they're oppressing Israel. We can assume Israel are crying out to God again. It's not mentioned. But as is often seen in the story of Israel, we have a parallel. God reaches out to Manoah, whose wife is childless, and says, "From you will come a saviour for Israel." And that saviour is Samson, whom the Spirit of the Lord begins to stir in when he's young, and he is supposed to be a Nazarite. The trouble is, although Samson's a Nazarite, that means he's devoted to God, he doesn't take his vow that seriously. First, he wants to marry a woman who's not Jewish, who's not a Hebrew, but a Philistine. Big problem. But God is using this to start a quarrel with the Philistines. He also kills a lion, which is amazing because the Spirit of God comes upon him in a vineyard. Not sure what he was doing in a vineyard. Maybe he didn't have any choice. But what he really shouldn't have done is what he does next. He goes back to the lion and takes some honey from some bees which are nesting in its carcass. He is not supposed to do that. You can read the story in Judges chapter 13 and chapter 14. 15 and 16 tell the rest of Samson's story. Samson marries the woman. It ends badly. He assumes they've slept with his wife to answer a riddle which he set them. What follows is a long cycle of killing on both sides. He sets fire to the Philistines' fields. They kill his family, his wife rather. He attacks the Philistines, they attack him. The most common known story is when with a donkey's jawbone, he kills 1,000 people. We don't know if that's true or not. But Samson's response is very interesting. Instead of giving the glory to God, it's with a donkey's jawbone, with a donkey's jawbone, I have made donkeys of them. With a donkey's jawbone, I have killed 1,000 men. And what does God get? He gets whinging, that's what. Now Samson's thirsty and he's going, you have given your servant this great victory. Must I now die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised? Well, frankly, guys, and I hope you forgive me for saying this, my thinking was God should have said, get lost, Samson. It's hardly gratitude. But again, you see God's grace. He gives Samson water, and Samson leads Israel for 20 years. But still, it's going wrong. Samson falls in love with a Philistine called Delilah. And we all know how that story ends. Because he's done that, he loses his strength, loses everything. Paradoxically, the theologian John Goldingday has pointed out all the women in this story seem to be victims of some kind. Samson's mother bears Samson, the hope of Israel, sees him fall apart. Samson's wife, whoever she is, the first one, we don't even know her name, loses everything. Everything and is a victim of everybody. A prostitute who Samson sleeps with, we didn't do that bit, but you can read the story. The Philistines try to capture Samson that way, and he only escapes by picking up the gates and carrying them off. Delilah, victim of her countrymen, find out Samson's strength and will give you silver. She becomes Samson's victor, he becomes her victim, and Samson, the strong man, the man who killed 1,000 men with a donkey's jawbone, is given women's labor, blinded, made to grind in a prison. He's grinding corn, a woman's job, the fifth woman in the story. It's over for him. Or is it? Samson's hair is growing again. And at the end of the story, as we all know, he defeats the Philistines by pulling down the temple of Dagon, the fish god, killing everyone in it along with himself. He probably didn't kill 3,000, as the story says. The temple would have been too small to hold that many. But we're assuming he killed the rulers of Israel, of the Philistines, and so saved Israel. And he's born back and laid in his father's tomb. His last prayer seems rather a selfish prayer. God, remember your servant, and let me have strength this one more time to take vengeance for my two eyes. God can use anybody. Samson now has a place in the book of Hebrews as one of the heroes of Israel. If Samson can get that, can't you? Now, you might think this is the end of the story. That's the last judge. But it isn't. There are 5 chapters to go. I'm not going to go into them in huge detail. You can read the whole story. But what they show is the conclusion of Judges. In those days, when there was no king in Israel, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And chapters 17 to 21 show what that looks like. First, we get Micah, a man who lives in the north of Israel. We're going north now. He has taken some money from his mother, but he obviously changes his mind and gives it back, and they make an idol out of it. At first, his theology just seems wobbly, but not disastrous. They're a long, long way away from Shiloh, where God is. They didn't know any better. There was no one to teach them. They dedicated the money to God. But unfortunately, after Micah has made it, he makes himself a priest. That should be okay. After all, if you're the head of the family, you're supposed to be a priest. But they're worshipping the idol. They're not worshipping God. You're immediately seeing trouble. And Micah assumes that because he's done that, God will bless him. And then he meets a Levite, one of the priests of Israel. They had no inheritance of their own. They wandered around living on people's charity. And he makes the man a really good offer. Come and be my priest and I'll pay you. And Micah says, because I now have a Levite as a priest, God will bless me. Wrong. Because in chapter 18, the tribe of Dan are looking for a home. The Philistines have thrown them out. Probably their fault for worshipping other gods. They take a city called Elash. They kill everybody in it and take it for themselves. For the first time in Judges, we receive sympathy, a sympathetic thought for people who aren't Hebrews. It's not condemned in the way we'd like, but it's seen as being a horrible, disgusting thing to do. And on their way to destroying Elash and calling it Dan, they steal Micah's idol. And they tell the priest who's there, come and be our priest. They give him an offer he can't refuse. Wouldn't you rather be the priest of a whole tribe instead of the priest of just one man's house? And the man agrees and goes with them. And Micah's told, clear off back home before somebody kills you. Be glad that you've escaped with your life. He loses everything when he thought having a priest in his house would mean a blessing from God. And in the last two chapters of Judges, we see Israel's first civil war. A concubine runs away from her husband. Now, nasty people have tried to use Judges chapter 20 as an argument that women should stay with their husbands however horrible they are, and what happens to the concubine afterwards is all her fault for running away. Actually, it doesn't say she ran away. The translation is that she was unfaithful to him. What that really means was she left him and went back to her father's house. That suggests to me there's something wrong with the guy. She is gang raped and killed by the tribe of Benjamin in a scene which is very much like what happened in Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis. You can read the story for yourself in Judges 20, but I warn you, it's not for the faint of heart. It's a horrible story. And for the first time, the whole of Israel gather to find out what's happened. And when they discover it's Benjamin's responsibility, they demand that Benjamin give them the men who did this horrible thing, and Benjamin go to war with them instead. They fight each other. They kill each other. And God appears to be very silent. When they ask him what to do, he just says, go up and fight them and send Judah first. And in the end, they defeat Benjamin, kill nearly all of them, and realize they've made another rash oath. We won't give any wives to the men of Benjamin. So they kill the men of Jabesh-Gilead to take their wives from them. Footnote, if you read the book of Samuel, you will see the men of Jabesh-Gilead are actually among the bravest men in all of Israel. It was a terrible thing to do. And because they still haven't got enough, they allow the Benjamites to take women from Shiloh, the place of the Lord, when they go up to celebrate before him. Now, do be aware before you really decide, how dare you? It was horrible. It was evil. It was disgusting. But we are living at a time where, sorry, they were living at a time, I should say, where abducting your bride was part of the marriage deal. It did happen. And she would fight like a wildcat when you tried to take her from your family. That was part of the ceremony. It's possible that was happening with some people, that they'd already made contracts that we don't know about. It's possible that some of the girls actually lived quite happily after that happened. This is a time where this kind of thing is common, but it doesn't excuse the terrible acts that take place in Judges 20 to 21. We have a broken people, a broken society, and God's plan seemed to have gone horribly wrong. It's no wonder that people who have read the book of Judges would like to read the book of Ruth now, or wonder why they started reading the book of Judges at all. The argument the book of Judges makes is the people of Israel need a king, because when there's no king, they do whatever they want. But as Jotham's parable shows, what kind of person can be our king? When the right kind of person has a nice job and a nice livelihood of his own, thank you very much, he most certainly does not want the responsibility of being a king. And the kind of person who does want to be a king will be completely horrible. What do you do? As we know, a king came. His name was Jesus. And he showed the grace which we have seen right through the book of Judges, where God rescues his people again and again. But going back to the people of Israel in the book of Judges, the time would come when they realized it wasn't hanging together and demanded of Samuel that God give them a king. But Samuel is another story.